So for those I haven't met, my name is Carrie Peterson. I'm one of the teachers here at Seattle Insight. And our usual format is we sit for 40 minutes. So I'll offer some light guidance and also have a chance to sit quietly together. And then I'll offer some reflections on our monthly theme, and we'll have a chance to talk about that together, discuss that a little bit together. So this is a poem that we can close the sitting with tonight. There are two titles to it. One is In Service to Life, and the other is For This I Walk Outside. This is by Rosemary Wotola Tromer. Not to escape the world, but to be more holy in it. Sharp cold stings my cheeks, not like a slap, but like the thrilling burn of whiskey as it blazes down the throat, the kind of wild aliveness that brooks no choice but to wake up to life, to champion it, to know life as the most wondrous thing, even as they steep in the ugliness we humans commit. This is what life asks of us. I walk outside to be more holy here. Here the way the Steller's Jay is here. Even on the coldest day, it's every fluffing, every peck, every head bob, every flight is in service to life. It's never confused about its purpose. I want to be in service. Outside, everything is teacher, the cold, the snow, the bird, the day, this fallible, fabulous human race, this improbable, beautiful planet in space. To serve life, I must inhabit it wholly. And be inhabited by it too, as if it all could end tonight, as if it all goes on forever. Okay, so we're rounding out the month on faith. The topic is faith, or sadha. And I was trying to calculate, if you've been attending everything at Seattle Insight this month, this could be at least the 11th talk you've heard on faith, right? So I don't know whether to celebrate that or anyway, yes. So anyway, that's plenty of inspiration. And one of the wonderful things about going through a theme like this for a month or a year is that we really get to steep in it. We get to kind of live, breathe, talk in that theme. And hopefully you've had an opportunity to do this, not only hear different voices and make it like a comparative religion class, which it could be, but to just really let yourself kind of orient and move around one Dhamma theme or topic. And the wonderfully kind of elegant way that the Dhamma exists is that you enter into anything fully with sincerity and openness and curiosity, and you find yourself in everything. Right? So this move that we're in this month from suffering to faith, it's like, this could be the whole thing, right? This could be the whole thing. And one of the wonderful things about being a teacher, as challenging as it is that you really also have to live in the theme, right? Especially if you don't have a lot of time to prepare. Oftentimes I'll just set out, like, okay, let me understand everything I can about faith, right? And then it's like everything answers back in a way with that kind of intentionality. So I'm at Trader Joe's this evening, just running in and out with several things, trying to carry them all in my hands on the way out, trying not to purchase a bag, like the 85th bag that I own. And I'm stacking all these things in my hands. And I told the clerk, I think I can do this. I think I can do this. And he looks right at me and he says, I believe in you. And I was like, that's it. And I could feel it. It was like a transmission of faith. It was faith, right? So, right. So, right, which Trader Joe's was that? So you end up living, in weird ways, you end up living the talk. So that's really the invitation that I hope we can be a part of as we enter into this. And it's such a beautiful journey, this deepening of faith. I spent several weeks last fall teaching from Sharon Salzberg's book on faith. So with the Vashon Insight Sangha, we went through for a few months and we just used her book as a reference. So I hope people have had a chance to kind of dip into that. But she has three more, but essentially kind of three steps with the deepening of faith. And I know it's likely that others have mentioned aspects of it. But this first aspect of faith is a kind of bright, inspired faith that is the faith of aspiration, where we get a glimpse of the possible. Right. So let me back up for a second. So we're moving in a broad way over this year as we look at the map of transcendent dependent origination. We're looking at the law of conditionality, how everything is dependent on the conditions coming together in a certain way. For its arising, that nothing has a separate, inherent, independent existence all on its own. It's all leaning and contingent on different factors and qualities and conditions that came before it. So with the more traditional link, or the more traditional map, we look at the conditions that come together to give rise to continued birth as a self and continued suffering, right? So we bring awareness to any of those links and it kind of shifts the whole cycle. So this is a cycle that has a tendency to repeat, sometimes called the samsaric cycle. And it's rather like an addictive cycle, right, in that it feeds on itself, and suffering tends to lead into more ignorance, more confusion, and that confusion tends to generate more suffering. All right, so this is like a map of the unawakened mind, and we all are tracing that map at times. It's not like we graduate from one and then the graduate course is the transcendent dependent arising. We're all retracing. Anyone noticed some repetition in your habitual patterns? Right? It's repetitive. So this is kind of how we tend to get stuck. So this is an important map to notice. It's an important territory to study. How is it that suffering arises? But then we have this whole other map in which we can track how the energy that was once caught in that circular repetitive loop, can break free and follow a whole nother pattern, right? A whole nother lawful sequence that gains its own momentum, like water flowing down a mountainside, gains its own momentum and goes in the direction of greater freedom. Right? And we can feel that, we can sense into that. So it hinges on this movement from suffering to faith. So when we experience a moment of suffering, a moment of dukkha, a moment of, in the words of a teenager, preteen at home, always asking about, you know, trying to foster some emotional intelligence. So, okay, how would you describe that feeling? This is in my preteen son. He's like, ugh. So sometimes it's as basic as that. But what happens next? What happens next? Does the discomfort and the displeasure of that moment generate a habitual reaction that leads to more suffering, more solidity, more tension, more stress? Or is there a little bit of pause? And is there a glimmer of possibility in that moment? Is it possible that this could go in a different direction? It's like something leaps free for a moment. Yeah. So this is the movement from suffering to faith. And I like Sharon Salzberg's description of how it deepens, because in its, and there are all places where we're all of these. There are places where our faith is still bright and aspirational. Yeah. Maybe we've seen somebody who's embodied a quality that we admire. Maybe we've gone on retreat and had some falling away and glimpsed kind of a deeper, brighter dimension of mind. Maybe we've had a psychedelic experience where our sense of reality has shifted a bit. This does not let us off the hook from the groundwork of integrating, of practicing, of bringing that inspirational moment into every aspect of our daily existence, into every moment of dukkha, right? But we need this inspiration, this uplift. So in the Pali, faith has a quality of uplift. Yeah. So in this aspirational kind of early dimension of faith, we can get enamored with the possibility, right? We can get intoxicated with the possibility and get a little bit lost. So this is sometimes called bright faith, and it's, we need it for its uplift, but this is also where we may find ourselves, this can also be blind faith. Right. This can also be where we sign up for the charismatic leader who ends up to be not quite what was on offer, right? So this is, faith is always balanced by wisdom, always balanced by wisdom. And so sometimes the faith gets a little bit far ahead and the wisdom takes a little bit to catch up. Sometimes we so privilege this discerning quality and this clear seeing that we can't actually allow for that leap that moves beyond our immediate discernment. Yeah, we need that leap. So people even talk about it as a leap of faith. We need the energy of that brightness to take the next step into the unknown. So this is how I like to translate faith. The willingness to open-heartedly, wholeheartedly meet the next moment of experience without expectation of outcome. Right? So it's, in a way, it's a willingness to stay open, to explore, to take the next step, but it needs that kind of energy of possibility. Yeah. So when we experience the dukkha of suffering, instead of, oh no, who can I blame? Oh no, what did I do wrong? Oh no, this shouldn't be happening. Oh no, this is a problem I've got to fix or solve. Oh no, what's happened here? There's, oh yes, I have the resources to meet this. Or, oh yes, I know what's happening. Yeah. Oh yes, I know what's happening. Yeah. Can you feel that kind of different orientation? So this is when bright faith starts to become verified faith. So before I do that, I just want to read a little bit from Sharon. And this, I think, made it into her book at one point. But she starts by quoting the Buddha, who was talking about how this is possible for all of us. Yeah. This is possible for all of us. And I've heard Sharon repeat this over and over again, so it's in my mind like a mantra. So I can hear her repeating, if it weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it. It is possible. It is possible. So this is the sutta that she's referring to. It's Anguttara Nikaya 2:19. Abandon what is wholesome, practitioners. One can abandon the unwholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do so. If this abandoning of the unwholesome would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to abandon it. But as the abandoning of the unwholesome brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, abandon what is unwholesome. Cultivate what is wholesome, practitioners. One can cultivate the wholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. If the cultivation of the wholesome would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to cultivate it. But as the cultivation of the wholesome brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, cultivate what is wholesome. And then Sharon goes on to say in this article that this is her favorite sutta for many reasons. One is that the mind of the Buddha sees suffering, and does not blame people for suffering or chastise them for it, but rather than condemning them, he sees those heading towards the end of suffering and rejoices for them. It also inspires a feeling of self-confidence within one. It can be done. I can do it. Many times, if I find difficulty in the teaching, when I'm very honest about it, it is because I fear I'm not capable of actualizing it. When I feel confidence in myself, my love for the teachings grows exponentially. Isn't that an interesting parallel? So when I first went to Sayadaw Upandita for metta instructions, he asked me if I thought I was going to be successful at it. And I thought, oh, he's looking for conceit. He's looking for pride. He's looking for that the kind of sense of I can do it. I replied, well, I don't know whether I'll be successful or not. I'm not sure. He then shook his head vehemently and said, "You must always approach things with the attitude that you can be successful. This is what the Buddha taught." So I love many things about that, but I love the link between feeling a sense of her own confidence and the love of the teachings coming together. Often when we're not connecting, we're stuck in some trap of not trusting ourselves to understand or engage or find our own way with the teachings. Not that they're always completely right in the sense of a capital R, that they need to be believed or we need to adhere to some kind of dogma or doctrine, but there's the sense that we can practice and find our way. That is the confidence or faith that the Buddha's referring to. So this bright faith deepens into a kind of verified faith. So after we've tested and investigated and sensed things for ourselves, it becomes a bit steadier, right? It may not have this enamored kind of spark, enamored and intoxicated with the possibilities, but there's a steadier, kind of deeper sense of, ah, oh, this is trustworthy. Yeah. This is trustworthy. I can settle here. I can be here. This is okay. This is practicable. I can do this. It's a bit more, it's verified. It's been confirmed. It's more in our bones, in our blood. And the kind of deepest or the direction of when faith is very mature, it's said to be abiding. So this is where it becomes unshakable. Yeah. So we don't have to demand that it be unshakable from the get-go. Right? That's not the process. This is a gradual process. But the direction we're heading is into a kind of faith or confidence that does not shake, right? That even given a great magnitude of challenge, of uncertainty, of unknown, there is confidence that there is a way forward. So, again, this is pointed to as being deep, steadfast, unshakable. And at this point, there's no need for a leap, right? Because we're already completely abiding at ease within the unknown. So this is the kind of maturing of faith. And just to note a couple things before I open this up for your reflections. But it's not just suffering that gives rise to faith, but it's an awareness of suffering, right? If there's no clear, open awareness of the suffering, we are just bound into a repetitive cycle. The repetitive cycle can feel like being kind of pulled underwater again and again, getting a few little bits of air and then being sucked in again and again, or it can feel like monotony and sameness. Yeah? It can feel like autopilot. Nothing new is ever happening. I'm so rarely surprised by anything. It's just more of the same. Right? This is also the repetitive, kind of automatic. So it's as though all of our energy, all of our awareness is just trapped. Yeah? It's not gone. It's not lost. It's just like stuck. So many images for this, but it's like a whirlpool that gets still water, still part of the river. It just gets stuck in a little eddy, right? So the encouragement to practice in this way. So I mentioned like, different aspects of faith, confidence, trust. We can practice in the time frame of our life so far. We can look at the patterning in our life so far and look back at where on our path has suffering given rise to faith or confidence? Where has it kind of shot off in a different direction? Where has there been that glimmer of possibility? We can look at it as a pattern that occurs over life. We can look at it situationally. So we enter a family gathering. We enter a practice space with Sangha. We enter a retreat day. And we can kind of trace it over that time. Is it possible that suffering could give rise to trust? And then from trust, it moves on to joy, happiness, tranquility, steadiness. So we can look at it at the in the time frame of a lifetime, of a situation, or in just a moment. Yeah, just moment by moment. Moment by moment, watching our mind be able to sense a little glimmer of possibility, but also being able to sense where are we already free? This is another aspect of deepening faith. Where are we already free? Over the course of our life, maybe in a situation, or in a moment, where are we already free? Ajahn Suchito has another image that I've come back to again and again. And this is one of a knot. So this is like a rope that's tangled up in a knot. Again, it's still rope. It's still elements bound together, but it's in a knot. So it can't be used as fully and as freely. He said, how do you untie a knot? How do you untie a knot? You go where it's easiest. You go where it's already a little bit loose, and you start to kind of pull from there. Yeah. If we are so fixated on where we're stuck, and we're convinced that that's the only thing that's happening, we pull the knot tighter and tighter. Right? So we need to know about the hindrances. We need to know about where we get stuck. We need to know about the territory of getting entangled. And we need to also be as specifically aware of all the places where we're wriggling free already. Yeah, it's already happening. When somebody tell me in a one-on-one meeting once, almost like as a confession, you know, like something she shouldn't admit. She said, I think I can feel myself evolving. You know? Like, yes, yes, right? It's never a straight line. It's never all at once. But yes, we need to get a sense. And it should be, that should delight us, you know, when we see that in other people. When we see that in ourselves, that should really delight us. So sometimes we're afraid of joy in practice, but hopefully this year we'll disavow you. Thank you. Clapping in the hall. hopefully this year will disavow you of that. It's just a bias that got stuck. I once got a note, an anonymous note that said, "Carrie, I'm not sure, but I think I heard you mention that the path could be joyful last night." She's like, "Are you crazy?" This, you know, basically saying I was a heretic for mentioning that joy was a possibility. Joy is a part of our path. It is a part of our path. We need the energy of joy. It's not a matter of giving ourselves a pep talk and saying it's all going to be fine in the end. Just look on the bright side. It is not that. It is not that. It is much, much deeper than that. It is actually feeling how we are freer in this practice. Little bits every day, little drops, little bits where we notice there's a little more space, there's a little more kindness, there's a little more clarity. But no, I'm still hindered. I'm still hindered. Yes, we're all still hindered, and we are in the process of disentangling. So to notice the wonder of that is how faith, joy, happiness lead to a kind of settling and ease. Yes, I can't lose it. Yes, it's all water. Even if it's stuck, I can't lose it. Yes, it feels good to be awake. It feels good to be part of a community that is committed to being awake, to be speaking language of kindness and goodness. That feels good. That feels good. So, yes, I feel excited. I wanted to just close. I had this when I was thinking about what I wanted to share tonight. This image of a 101-year-old, one of the dearest clients I ever worked with, nearing the end of her life, who really felt as though she had lived a good life. She was grateful. She was ready to die. She was ready to let go. Her body hurt. She was felt like she had kind of done what had lived purposefully and kindly and was ready to go. But every time she tried to stop eating and drinking so she could die, she couldn't do it. Yeah, she's just like, "But Carrie, the pudding. It was just, it was so sweet. Anyway, she couldn't do it. And so she would get discouraged. And, you know, she kept finding things that were delightful about being alive, even though it was really hard. And then I happened to be with her in the moments when she died, when she took her last breaths. And it wasn't, you know, it was rather sudden, wasn't expecting it. And, you know, as happens, there was an in-breath, and there was an out-breath, and then there wasn't another in-breath. And there were a few of us who were waiting, you know, just waiting. And then when we all realized that she had passed, I felt this burst of joy kind of come through me. And it was almost like, who knows, right? Who knows? But for me, it felt like, we'll call her Ellen, felt like Ellen had just like, "I did it." Yeah. It's like, "Oh, I did it." So who knows? But there was this delight at having let go, of being able to let go. And when we do this kind of switching of paradigms, we are going against some of our deepest, most instinctual fears and wants, right? So that is no small thing. And we don't have to fight them. We don't have to struggle with them. We can understand them. And in that understanding, we wriggle free. Okay, so let's just sit for a moment. So may each of us remember awareness, the possibility of awareness in every moment. May each of us remember our own capacity, that it is possible. And may each of us delight and take joy in how the practice is unfolding within us. Okay, I appreciate you all, really. Yeah. Thank you. We'll open it up first and see if there are any of your own reflections, comments from this month. Really anything that might be arising for you. Happy to ask more specific questions, but before I do that, maybe just see if anybody has anything. Yeah, please, in the back. And just wait for the mic, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Thank you. I was at the session last night, the online one, and they talked about the same thing, bright faith, the other faith.
Yeah.
And then they also talked about doubt.
Yeah.
I was curious if you could just touch on doubt a little bit on this topic.
Yeah. So the question of doubt. So I think we can expect that doubt will be a part of our practice. Stephen Batchelor has this wonderful book title called The Faith to Doubt. So we can include doubt as part of our practice. And like I was saying at the end, the awareness of it, we are a little bit free from its grip. So you might really make, if doubt was really a primary hindrance for me early on, and many of you know, when Rodney first asked me to start giving talks, he said, well, just speak about something you know really, really well. And I said, okay, well, so I gave like 10 talks on doubt. So knowing the way that doubt moves, doubt isn't the opposite of faith in a way, but faith allows us to remember the awareness that can know and not be kind of overcome by doubt, right? So don't feel like you have to talk yourself into a belief, yeah, or you have to be completely certain in order to take the next step. So that's sort of the illusion of doubt, right? Is that if I can just figure out what is the right way and do that, then I won't have to suffer. Yeah, isn't that what it says? Because doubt is always, it's very circular. It's like, is this right? Should I be here? Am I doing it right? Is this right or is that right? Is it this or is it that? Well, if I try this, maybe that might happen. But if not, maybe it won't. You know, it's very, like, it stands back. It tries to assess the situation without engaging and tries to find the safe passage through where I won't have to suffer. Yeah, at least that's my experience of it. And so every time it pops up, should I, you know, am I up for this? This is too hard. I don't know if I can do it. Like, okay, that's doubt. And so awareness can come and embrace that kind of trembling, that uncertainty. Step back. Yeah, this is the mind kind of afflicted by doubt. Yeah. And so then it becomes it doesn't overtake or hijack awareness. It actually becomes a place of learning. Yeah. So I love in the book, Sharon talks about despair as being the opposite of faith, not doubt. Doubt can lead to skillful questioning. It can lead to gathering more information. It can lead to seeking guidance. It can lead in a lot of helpful directions. But despair is really a giving up. We're not engaged anymore. We've decided that nothing is possible here. And so we've contracted and withdrawn. And that's when we kind of sink. So she said the real, can't remember exactly how she phrased it, but something like, what we abandon is cynicism and apathy, and recognize when we've fallen into despair. Yeah. So I hope that speaks to it a little bit. Doubt's a wonderful place to practice, but it's only when we believe that we can figure it out all up here ahead of time and kind of be immune from any vulnerability that it doesn't work. It's really the willingness just to kind of take that step off a 100-foot pole that they say in Zen, you know, and not trust that it's all going to work out okay or you're not going to end up scraped or anything, but just that you can do it and that awareness will be there. Be aware in that next moment. Yeah, hi, Emery.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your talk. It was really touching and beautiful. So thank you for that. While we're talking about doubt, I wanted to bring up a question that's come up over the course of this month for me that is kind of on the edges of doubt. And it has to do with, this kind of sounds silly, but like the efficiency of each of us going on this long, beautiful, but arduous, time-consuming, resource-consuming, sometimes it feels very self-focused, because I understand the concept that if, you know, the more free I am, the more free I can be with my love and I can be supportive of others in a different way. But sometimes I'm just like, what if we all took all this energy and like volunteered or wrote our congresspeople more? I don't know. So it is very heady and mindy, but sometimes, and it reminds me of when the Buddha was like, sort of like, do I deserve this? You know? And I do believe that I personally deserve it. Or, you know, that all of us deserve to be free from suffering and have hearts full of love. But it just seems like I'm waiting for a critical mass. And I don't know if it's going to, if we have enough time. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah, you are. You are. It seems to me that it's the question of, you know, the world's on fire. Mm-hmm. Is this the best use of my time and energy? Am I really benefiting others in doing this practice? Exactly. So first of all, you should write your Congress people. You should do all those things. Do you notice a difference in the way that you're relating to people around you and your experience of being in the world from practice, even in a small way. Do you notice that? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we had more time, I'd ask you about specifics and have you linger there in those place, that place where you notice. And, you know, this is something that I think all of us who are really committed to this path will come up against at some point. And I think it is a form of doubt. Like, is this the best use of my time and energy? But rather, again, rather than trying to figure out that question from up here, that's the waste of time. That's the waste of time. You know, engaging with the moment as it presents itself in all of its terror and wonder and possibility and agony, that is never a waste of time. Yeah. So, but what you can do also, Emery, is every morning and every time you sit, that intention to be of benefit to all beings has tremendous energy. Mm. So bring that like front and center into your practice, you know, and because that has a lot of, that has a lot of energy. So the intention to be of use in whatever environment you find yourself in, not in a compulsive helping way, but in a, let me be open to this for the benefit of all beings, that is powerful. So.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That's really helpful.
Great. And so those phrases that strike you as being really true in the moment of doubt, that is a good thing to repeat, to remind yourself. Yeah. May I be open to this moment for the benefit of all beings. Let me stay in not knowing for the benefit of all beings. I won't go on. Our world needs a change of consciousness. You know, it needs new policy and new regime and all of that. But we need a leap. We need a leap. You know, it's like that quote of Einstein's: "The problem will never be solved with the same consciousness that created the problem." Right? And we can feel that. We can feel that. Yeah. So, okay. I could go on and on. You know, you're welcome. Yeah. So many wonderful models of faith lately, right? Models of doubt and destruction as well, but there are lots of models of people who are embodying that and living that. They're everywhere. Yeah, Deborah.
Yeah, I've been kind of mulling over the difference between faith and hope.
Yeah.
And I just read today Sharon's explanation, which is very beautiful. And I wonder if you could comment on that. Hope is like a form of craving.
Yeah.
And faith is a form of opening that is so different, because I've just been, well, what's the difference? And now I guess I think I've got some inkling to that, but I wish you could, I would love to hear your comments on
Thanks,
that.
Deborah. Yeah. I've thought a lot about that too. And, you know, I think some people use hope in the way that we're using faith. So I think that it depends on how you hold it. But I think that hope is really hope for how I want it to end up, you know, that's what, so in a way that's a form of just wanting the outcome, like, oh, I hope my team wins. I hope, you know, that this works out in the end. I hope, so there is a kind of, the difference is the fixity on the outcome that I prefer. Whereas faith is really the openness and the willingness to take the next step into the unknown, even though it might not work, even though, you know, it might, we don't know if it's possible. It's the willingness to kind of step forward anyway. So Rebecca Solnit, who I'm deeply devoted to, uses the word hope. Hope in the Dark is one of her wonderful books. But she uses it in much the same way as we're using the word faith, which is to stay open to possibility in the midst of uncertainty, and not to, she draws this distinction between optimism on the one hand and pessimism on the other hand, and both of those are dead ends, you know? That, like, oh, it's all going well, it's all going to work out, everything's just great, and then on this end, like, this is all terrible, it's all going down the tubes, we're all sunk. You know, in a way, both of those are true, and neither of those are true. But the path of faith is to stay in the uncertainty when it doesn't seem known, and to open and take the next step. Anyway, does that speak to it a little? Yeah. Yeah. It's a great distinction. And, you know, much of the conversation around climate change uses this word hope. And I think some of it is used in the same way, that even though statistically it does not look good, yeah, it does not look good, there is a sense of not giving up and not giving into despair that is a lot like faith or hope in, anyway. We'll stop there. You could keep going, but let me see if anybody else has another couple comments, and then we'll close. So,
thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to your earlier request for just practice throughout the week, how that's been going. I was just wondering if you could speak to. Through practice, I notice changes in my own life, right? Changes in, like, what I enjoy, the type of speech I enjoy, which feels good to me, personally. But the relation that other people have of who the I am to them may not coincide or be enjoyable to them, right? Or of what they thought was you, right? Or me in this case. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that or any kind of, yeah, this is what something I've been working on through my practice.
Yeah. I definitely don't think it works out that we're pleasing to everybody all the time when we start to practice. Yeah. So in noticing fruits in our relationships, I don't think it translates that we become what everybody wants us to become. I've become far less of what other people wanted me to become by being on the path, right? So that's not where to gauge whether your practice is kind of like how it's going. You know, it's more, do you feel like there's more integrity with yourself? Do you feel more of a sense of kindness and appreciation for other people? You know, there will be praise and blame. We don't get out of that. We don't get out of that. Yeah, some people will approve, some people will not. But it's more, am I in alignment? Yeah, and do I have something I can offer? Am I relating? You can feel when you're relating, you have more resources to relate skillfully, yeah, rather than from automatic pilot. So, yeah. But have people who've been practicing for a while, has everybody been on board with your transformation? Yeah. No. So be in good company, you know? That's why we kind of help create the culture, the support for how we want to be. Yeah, but thank you. It's actually a tender, can be a really tender place. Yeah. And one more in the back. Oh, that's Adam. Thank you, Adam.
Hey, Carrie.
Hey.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. A lot of it resonated very deeply with me, but I think the thing I want to maybe comment on, and maybe there's a question in here, is on the topic of joy and kind of using that. I think the way you described it was with the analogy of a knot and like kind of going with what's easiest in a way to untangle it.
Yeah.
And I guess my comment is I'm like too protective of my joy. Like I want to like keep it separate from the muck, so to speak. And like really it seems to really be a thing where it's like, I have a hard time like getting my hands dirty in that way where it's like they're suffering. And when I know I'm suffering already, it's actually easier to like cope with and like kind of ride that and say, okay, this is suffering. And then when I'm coming off, say, even this weekend, which was kind of a just a more joyful experience, and then I come back to work, which is, you know, there's stress and things involved, I have this like clinging to being like, no, that joy is a separate thing. Like I almost don't want to spend it to start untangling it. That's not, it's like its own thing. I don't know if that makes sense, but I don't know if you have any elaboration on that of, I don't know, how to use joy or like how to conceptualize that. Cause I think it's something that I've definitely struggled with.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it seems as though you're treating joy as it's kind of like a limited commodity, right? And you, just that sense of not wanting to waste it. So I would just be interested, you could hold it as an open question, if those two kind of realities could merge a little bit more. Seems like maybe there's a way you have of like coping or getting through work that feels very like you have to stay focused, or there's just a certain way of orienting to that. But maybe in the middle of that, you may just ask, you may just float some questions. You know, is there anything right now that's okay already? You know? So it's not like joy is something that you get once and you kind of try to get it to bleed into everything else. But it's more like it opens a little door. Yeah. And so you can kind of check at different times of the day. Like, not am I doing good or doing bad? Like joy is right. Frustration is wrong. But just where is it? Where is it okay here in this moment already? Yeah. So remembering that this is going towards a kind of settledness of mind that can see more clearly. So it's not so much joy for its own sake, although that's wonderful. It's not an end point, but it's joy that is content to be where it is, so we can see more clearly what's actually happening. So joy is not like the end prize that we get at the end for doing everything right. but we can tap into it at different times. Yeah. So you may just start with, is it possible? How might I bring my practice to work in general? Yeah. How might I integrate practice with work? That might be kind of a more open question. And they could be just simple questions like, is awareness present? What is here already that's okay? So anyway, could ask a lot more inquiry questions around that. But as a way of kind of bringing those two realities together, like this is joy, this is practice, this is work, right? See if we might kind of poke some holes in that boundary or separation a little bit. Can't see you, Adam, but I trust you're listening. Okay.
Yeah. No, thank you. That is really helpful.
Okay.
I think kind of what I hear in that answer too is just maybe an encouragement to be a little more present focused. It reminds me of a movie called Old Joy, and in it they have this line where they're like, sorrow is just old joy. And so that's kind of what it feels like sometimes, is like that joy of yesterday becomes the sorrow if you try to kind of hang on to it too much.
That's right. Yeah, that's one definition of dukkha also. You know, not having what we want, right? Not having what we want, being separated from what we want. So that could spurn, instead of spawning more sorrow, that could spark a practice question. Like, what's happening here? Wait a minute. Yeah. So let's see, bringing yourself fully present into that moment. Even if you're at work, you're just trying to get through it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ryan, and then we should stop.
I really like the discussion about joy. I think it's such a great theme for faith too.
Yeah.
And I just want to make the observation too that, you know, one of the four Brahma Viharas is mudita.
Yeah.
And mudita, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh defines it as joy.
Yeah.
And one of the aspects, really special aspects of the Brahma Viharas is that they're also called the boundless qualities.
Yeah.
And they're called the boundless qualities because the more that we practice them, the more that our capacity to experience them increases boundlessly. And so it's to the point that you sort of made at the beginning, it's actually, they're not a finite resource.
Yeah.
And in fact, the more we spend this resource, the more we develop and build and expand that capacity. Mm-hmm. And it's true of also of equanimity and of the other Brahma Viharas as well,
right.
Compassion and loving kindness.
That's right.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Joy. Bring it to work.
That's right. And that also what you described as that moving to the more boundless capacity of practice is also the sense of momentum as that water's going downhill and it's filling up. You know, the rivers fill up the streams, fill up rivers, fill up gullies, fill up lakes. You know, basically there's a sense of expanding and overflowing. So that's practice gaining momentum and overflowing. And that happens when we become more continually aware through all of our moments. And it also happens when we're aware of those resources, like you said, and that, oh, every time I am aware of that, when I'm aware of the wholesome, it deepens. When I'm aware of the unwholesome, I gain understanding.
And that's such a good faith practice.
Yes.
It's a perfect faith practice.
Yeah.
That I know that, you know, okay, I can practice this joy and it's going to, the faith is that it's going to continue to expand and give me more.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't, then we have a moment of suffering, mm-hmm. which can also spurn a kind of confidence. Oh, I know this. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when we feel contraction, it's not that we've erred or something's wrong with us or something's wrong out there,
yeah.
but that's a practice moment also.
And it's one of the special things about the Brahma Viharas, I was listening to a teacher just over the weekend on this topic, is that they can be brought in, it's a faith component, they can be brought in response to the suffering,
yeah.
right? It's that this is actually a practice I have with work as a manager, is to say, okay, you are suffering in this way. Now, how do we bring about a positive reaction to that to unlock? So,
yeah.
Thanks again.
Yeah. So we're going in the direction of joy with this I may just have to come up with an acronym like TDO, Transcendent Dependent Origination. We're going in the direction of joy, and the Brahmaviharas are, that's, it's another wonderful map, and that's a relational map. So, but the territory overlaps for sure. So great. All right, everybody. So appreciate your practice tonight. Appreciate your reflections on Dana, and more than that, really appreciate your listening tonight and your practice and sincerity. So may this be of benefit to ourselves and all beings everywhere, without exception.